Are the Ten Commandments binding on the consciences of Christians? What about the other aspects of the Mosaic Code? For instance, when should we worship? Should we worship on Saturday or Sunday? And what should we do on that day of worship, and what should we be restricted from doing on that day of worship? On occasion, the men in this church have gotten together on Sunday afternoons after the service and have played tag football, flag football. Is that permissible? Or must we dedicate the whole day exclusively to the worship of Jesus Christ? Is it all right for you to leave the service and go work this afternoon? Engage in employment. Are there restrictions on the food and the drink that we ingest? When we want to know what God expects of us as Christians who belong to this new covenant community inaugurated with the blood of Jesus Christ, where do we turn in the Scriptures to find those instructions for our moral guidance? Now, this is both a controversial and an important subject, and we have been leading up to these kinds of questions in our study on the New Covenant. What we are really asking is this: what is the relationship of the New Covenant with the Old Covenant? Last week we saw in Matthew chapter 5, verses 19 through 20, that Jesus has fulfilled the Old Covenant law by His teaching. I mentioned last week that it is also, of course, true that He has fulfilled the Old Covenant law by His actions, by His perfect, active obedience to the law. But we, in Matthew chapter 5, are not talking about how He lives. We are talking about what He says. And it is His teaching that also fills full the law and the prophets. He says in verse 17, "Don't think that I have come to destroy the law and the prophets. I have not come to destroy, but to plerao, to fulfill, to fill it full." And He is here to do that not only by His actions, but also through His teaching. So that following this section, we have the famous six antitheses, where Jesus says, "You have heard it said of old," and then He quotes Moses. And then He goes, "But I say to you," and then He lays out His authority over Moses. Now, this is remarkable, and you can imagine how scandalous it was in the first century. Moses was the preeminent figure of all of the Old Testament, with the exception maybe of Abraham. Moses occupied a preeminent position in Jewish life. For Jesus to say, "Moses has said this, but now I say to you," would have really stirred up a hornet's nest in his day. In fact, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, at the very end of chapter 7, when He is finished with this teaching, the people who are listening look at one another in somewhat an astonished fashion, and they say, "This is amazing. This man teaches with authority. He doesn't teach like the scribes and the Pharisees teach, who were fond of quoting rabbis and their interpretations of the Torah." Jesus isn't giving His interpretation of the Torah. He is saying, "This is what I say to you." He is exercising His authority over the Torah. Now that's remarkable. And that's authoritative. And that's how He fills full the Old Testament law and the prophets. Everything He says in what we would today call the Old Testament, the law and the prophets, finds its fulfillment in Me. So that if you want to know what Moses said, and what Moses meant, and how significant it was to have the Mosaic Code, you have to go through Christ. Because He stands for us the sole interpreter of Moses. In other words, we read the Old Testament through the lens of the New Testament, not vice versa. Now, this is very important to questions concerning worship, concerning the issue of the Sabbath of the Lord's Day, concerning issues like baptism, what is the Lord's table and who should be admitted to it, and a whole host of other issues that we're going to tease out and flesh out over the next several weeks. That's why we're talking about this. Now, I want to remind you that long before Moses went up on the Mount of Sinai and received from God the tablets of stone and brought back to Israel that law, that man still had law before then. Now, maybe we forget that sometimes. But people who existed long before Moses ever went up to Mount Sinai knew the law of God. There was a law that existed that all men knew, and as a consequence, all men are accountable for. Now, please stay with me here, because this is very foundational to everything I'm going to say today. If you were to ask the Apostle Paul, "Paul, before Moses ever delivered the Ten Commandments and all of the rest of the Levitical laws to the nation of Israel, how could men be judged and condemned by God for their sin?" Paul would answer, "Because they knew better." Now, I want you to go with me to Romans chapter 2 to see this. Long before Moses delivered to Israel the Ten Commandments, the world knew what God required. Look at Romans chapter 1 and verse 18. "For the wrath of God," that is, God's anger, "is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are," and what are the next two words? "Without excuse." Now, for those of you who are in our adult Sunday school class, if I were to ask you right now what kind of revelation is Paul speaking of, I know that you would immediately in one voice say, "That's natural revelation, general revelation, the revelation that God has given to every person born into this world through both the created order as well as his conscience." And he speaks of his conscience in chapter 2. Look at verse 14. "For when Gentiles who do not have the law," he's talking about the Torah, the Mosaic Code, "for when Gentiles who do not have the Torah by nature do the things in the Torah, these, although not having the Torah, are a Torah to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them. These Gentiles who didn't have the Mosaic Code nevertheless fulfilled at least in some part the Mosaic Code, because God had written His law in their hearts and in their consciences." The point here should be clear to all of us. There is a standard of righteousness that is both universal and independent of Moses, engraved in every human without exception. That law spells out the general requirements of God and is sufficient to condemn every person. This, in part, answers the whole question of what about the native in Africa who has never heard the gospel? If you asked Paul what is their condition, he would say they are ungodly and unrighteous, and the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against them, because though they knew Him, they suppressed that knowledge. It is also true of the pygmy in New Guinea, as well as the heathen in Brooklyn. We all have this law universally given to us. So before Moses ever spelled out the specifics of the commands given to Israel, we had law. Even after God had given the Torah to Israel, the Gentiles, who were not part of that covenant community, were still held accountable for their actions, because written on their hearts and engraved in their consciences is the command and laws of God. Sometimes this is called natural law. It is remarkable, isn't it, that even in countries that have no Judaic and Christian basis to them, nevertheless often prosecute people who steal and who murder and who lie and so forth. Why is that? Why in even communist, officially atheistic countries do they have laws that in some respect reflect the Ten Commandments? It's because it reflects an internal knowledge that this is what God requires, and He has engraven that law on every human and every conscience. Every human conscience. Now, let's understand that people often harden themselves against that law. They sear their conscience, they harden their conscience, and they do what they want to anyway, but God says that's precisely why they're judged. Because knowing what's right, they disregard it. In fact, Paul would say then in Romans chapter 3 and verse 10, "There is therefore none righteous, no, not one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks after God. They have all turned aside. They have together become unprofitable. There is none who does good. No, not one." Just in case you didn't know what the word none says, Paul just reiterates this and says, no, not even one. "Their throat is an open tomb. With their tongues they have practiced deceit. The poison of snakes is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes." Now, do you get the impression by reading those words from the apostle that he says we're not in very good shape here on planet Earth? And that that law, whether it is in written, codified form, or whether it is merely the law of God engraved on our consciences through creation, is sufficient to condemn every one of us. There are no innocent people in this world. No, not one. So the question then is, if all men have the law of God written on their hearts, then why did God take care to codify it and give it to Israel? You ever thought about that? If we all have this universal knowledge of the general commands of God and what is required of us by Him, why did God spend the time to have Moses come up on the Mount of Sinai, spend 40 days with him, and give to Israel all the law? Why did He do that? Well, the answer to that question, of course, lies at the very heart of God's special relationship with the nation of Israel. You see, in giving to Israel the commands, He entered into special covenant with her. The Ten Commandments and all of the Levitical laws, which were merely an extrapolation of those Ten Commands, were themselves a covenant. Listen to Exodus 34, 27 and 28. "Then the Lord said to Moses, write these words, these ten words, what we call the Ten Commands. For according to the tenor of these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel." And He wrote on the tablets of the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. Now don't miss this point. What was given to Moses was nothing less than God cutting a covenant with this special, unique people. A people that were the physical descendants of Israel, of Jacob. And that in giving this law, He was taking the universal law that had been given to all men by birth, and He was writing it down in codified form and giving special instructions and more specific detail, especially for this people. There is no indication anywhere else that that law, that Torah, was universally binding on other nations around her. That Torah was specifically binding for this people in answer to the promises that God had made to Abraham. Because of its unique covenantal setting between God and Israel, it shouldn't surprise us then that this Mosaic law was not identical to the law of God in mankind and written on their consciences. Let me say that again. Because of the unique setting of God giving to Israel this covenant law, that law was not identical to the law of God written on the consciences and the hearts of every man. Let me give you a couple of illustrations if you're scratching your head and saying, I don't know about that, Tony. There is no indication anywhere in the history of mankind that man has ever sat down to a pork chop dinner and said, oh, I really feel guilty eating this pork chop. Right? The dietary restrictions given in the Levitical laws were not written on the hearts and consciences of men in general. There is no indication of that elsewhere. I'll go a step further, and we're going to talk about this at length next week. There is no indication, I think, scripturally, where the Sabbath command was ever written and engraved in the consciences of men. The special Sabbath commands and the festivals and the holy days were all part and parcel of the Levitical code given as part of this old covenant given to Israel. Man has an obligation to worship God. All of us know that. That's the law of God written on our consciences, engraved in our hearts, right? But in the Old Covenant, there were specific commands about worship that Israel alone was given. The feast, the special festival days, the Passover as an example. The Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. All of the special high and holy days that were part of the worship of Israel were part of the Torah given to Israel, but not given to men in general. You and I today are meeting on Sunday as opposed to Saturday. I didn't see anybody bring lambs, goats, and bulls with them today. But if the Torah were identical to the law of God, all of us would be required to do so. Note, these prescriptions were specific extensions of the eternal law of God, and they were obligatory on the people to whom they were given so long as that covenant was in force. Now let me stress it again. These commands which God gave to Israel were obligatory upon Israel in every detail so long as that covenant was in force. But if the old covenant gives way to the new covenant, then we can begin to understand why the New Testament views us not under the Torah. Why it speaks of the Mosaic Code in past tense. Why Jesus could say, Moses has said to you, but I say to you. Now, Jesus couldn't say that if the Torah were the identical duplication of the eternal law of God. We would all be responsible for it. They were not essential elements of the law of God itself. So, you shall have no other God before me is a prescription against idolatry. It is a prescription that we must worship God and God alone. I don't think there's anybody in this room who would disagree with the fact that that is part of the eternal law of God. That it is binding upon us today as it was binding upon Adam when he was created. But how we go about that worship, how we worship Him in details and in specifics, is very different today than what Israel was doing under the Old Covenant commands. It's also important to note, just in case you think that I'm leaning toward antinomianism here, it is also important to note that the law of God written on our hearts is almost identical with the Ten Commandments. Let me right say that again. The law of God written on our hearts is almost identical with the Ten Commandments. I would argue that the Ten Commandments are 9/10 of the eternal law of God. The one, number four, I think is not, and I will argue next week as to why the Sabbath command is not eternally binding on us. I don't want to steal my thunder from next week. Other than the fourth command, it would appear that there was a universal knowledge that theft, murder, idolatry, adultery, covetousness, and lying is absolutely wrong, and everybody through all times understands and knows that. So that the law of God undergirds the Mosaic law. The law of God is the foundation for the Torah, but it is not a duplication of it. There were specifics and details and prescriptions that were given to Israel at Sinai that are not universally binding on the rest of humanity. Now, I'm really not saying anything controversial here. Everybody agrees with this point. Where the disagreement comes is what part of the Torah is universally binding and what part isn't. We're going to talk about that in a moment. So the law of God undergirds the Mosaic Code, but the Mosaic Code is much more fuller and much more detailed, given greater specifics than the eternal law of God. Those commandments were obligatory as long as that covenant cut with Israel at Sinai was in force. And what we have seen over and over and over again in this study on the New Covenant is that that old covenant is no longer in force. Furthermore, the Torah had a very important redemptive purpose. The relationship that God had with Israel was not an end in and of itself. It was established to prove something essential to the outworking of God's redemptive purpose. The Old Covenant was essentially legal in nature. There is a debate within the church today as to whether or not the Old Covenant was legal or gracious. Just so that you know where I'm coming on this point, I think the Old Covenant, the Torah, the Mosaic Law, had a gracious purpose, but was essentially legal in nature. Now, here's what I meant. The way in which the New Testament interprets the Old is this, that the Old Covenant never had the capacity to justify you before God. Paul, in fact, says, if there was any law that could justify you before God, it would be this law. But by the doing of the law, no one will ever be justified. So why was the law given? It was given to ultimately lead us to the promises, to trust and believe in the promises of God to Abraham, that there would come one day to whom all of this law pointed forward to. All of the sacrifices, all of the worship, even the Sabbath day itself was designed to point to greater spiritual and eternal realities above and beyond itself. And in order to get you to look beyond the law to those promises, the legal aspect of the law had to hammer your sin. It had to lay out in front of you just what a lawless person you are, so that despairing of your own righteousness, you might look to the promises of God and believe in them and be justified the way your father Abraham was justified. By believing in the promises God gave to him, not in doing the works of the law. So that while there was a redemptive purpose in the giving of the law, namely to condemn us and lead us to Christ, make no mistake about it. The law, used lawfully, is designed to condemn us, not to justify us. It could never justify us. As Paul would say in Galatians chapter 3, and I'd like you just to turn over there and see this for yourself. Galatians 3, and look at verse 19. What purpose then does the law serve? It was added because of transgression, because of sin, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made. Now, who is the seed that was to come? Christ. How long was the law added to? Until Christ would come. That's clearly what he says. to whom was the promises were made, and it was appointed through angels by the hand of a mediator, being Moses. Now, a mediator does not mediate for one only, but God is one. Is the law then against the promises? Does it work at cross purposes with the promises given to Abraham? Certainly not. For if there had been a law given which could have given life, truly righteousness would have been by the law. But the Scripture has confirmed all under sin that the promise by faith in Jesus Christ might be given to those who believe. But before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law. Before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for the faith which would afterward be revealed. Therefore, the law was our tutor, our pedagogue, to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified. And then notice, but after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. Now, this must have struck Paul's readers, especially in Galatia, who had fallen under the Judaizers, as being intensely antinomian. It sounds like what Paul is saying here is that Christians are not under Moses. And I think, you know why it sounds that way? Because that's exactly what he's saying. Exactly what he's saying. That Mosaic code had a purpose, a redemptive purpose, to condemn us of our sin and to bring us to Christ. And it was given till that seed would come to whom the promises were given. When he came, we have been taken out from under that code because it was the old covenant given to Moses at Sinai. And now with the inauguration of the new covenant, the old covenant has passed away. Which leads us to our final point here. And the final point's about 20 minutes, so don't get excited. A new age has dawned. The new covenant has come. So maybe everything that I've set up to this point might lead you to think that what I'm saying is because the new covenant has come, we are no longer under law. Free from the law, O happy condition, I can sin as I please and still have remission. Do you think that's what the New Testament says? The answer, of course, is absolutely not. And here's why. As we've already seen, there was law before Moses. Why shouldn't we expect there to be law after Moses? The eternal law of God, which undergird and fortified the law of Moses, is eternal. It doesn't change, it doesn't go away. Just because the particular sanctions and specific details of the Torah given to Israel at Sinai no longer are binding on us. It doesn't mean that there's no law. It means you still can't steal. You still can't commit adultery. You still can't murder. You still must worship the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And so on and so forth. Covetousness is wrong. Lying is wrong. Because that's the eternal law of God. And when you come to the new covenant, all of those commands are not only given to us, but they are intensified. The new covenant law, and I've said this before and I'm going to say it again until everybody understands this. The new covenant law does not lower the bar, it raises the bar. You have heard that it was said of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that if any man looks after a woman to lust after her, he has committed adultery in his heart already. Nobody reading Exodus chapter 20, doing fair exegesis to the command against adultery, would have ever concluded that God equally condemns lust. Jesus says, that's the eternal law of God. And it was written on your consciences long before Moses was ever given the Ten Commandments. He raises the bar. He doesn't lower it. Moses said, look, if you're going to divorce your wife because of the hardness of your hearts, give her a writing of divorcement so that it at least protects her financial and health issues. Jesus says, let me tell you something. you divorce your wife except for the cause of adultery, and you have committed adultery yourself, and you are liable. He doesn't lower the bar, he raises the bar. That's what I'm talking about when I say that we read the Old Testament now through the lens of the New, because Christ in His teaching, as a consequence, His inspired apostles and their teachings tell us how to read Moses, how to understand what is binding upon us. Jesus clearly says that His teaching has filled full the law and the prophets. He stands above Moses. He is perfectly free to intensify His law. You have heard that it was said, "You shall not murder." I say to you, if you hate your brother without cause, you have committed murder. He can intensify it. He can also abrogate it. Moses has told you there are certain things that you mustn't take oaths by. I say to you, just don't take oaths at all. Not by heaven, not by the earth. Just don't take it at all. That's just doing away with the Mosaic command altogether. When Peter is up on the rooftop of the house of Cornelius, and the sheet comes down from heaven in the vision, and it's got all of this really succulent pork on it. Kind of in the mood for pork. And this voice comes from heaven and says, "Peter, take up and eat." Peter must think it's a test. And he's sitting there and he's saying, "Lord, it's unclean." And the voice comes from heaven and says, "What I've called clean, don't you call unclean. You have heard that it was said of old, 'You shall not eat pork.' I say to you, dig in and enjoy." This is why I say that the eternal law of God, written on the consciences and the minds of all humanity, is not identical to the Mosaic Code. Do you see what I mean by that now? It undergirds it. It stands as its foundation. But it isn't the same. So if you want to know what God requires of you, it isn't nearly enough to turn to the Torah. You must turn to Christ and His inspired apostles for their interpretation of that Torah. So how do we look at Moses? Well, some Christians assume Moses is binding unless they have new covenant grounds for repealing the legislation. Let me state that again. There are some Christians who would say, well, we read the Old Testament and we assume that those commands are binding to us unless we have new covenant instruction to say that they no longer are. Typically, these same groups of people say that the Torah has come to us in three parts. There are the civil commands, the way in which the nation of Israel was to be governed. There are the ceremonial commands, that is, all of the details about the Levitical sacrifices and the worship of the temple and the festival days and the high days and so forth. And then there are the moral commands as embodied in the Ten Commandments. Now, typically what you find in these groups, depending on where they fall on the spectrum, is that one or two of those three parts are done away with and are abrogated in Christ. I'm speaking specifically here about our Reformed brethren that are on the covenantal spectrum here of dispensationalism to covenantalism. Remember that a few weeks ago when we talked about that? In my view, the most consistent position covenantally are the groups that say only one aspect of the Mosaic Code is done away with. The civil aspects of the law and the moral aspects of the law are still binding. Now, if you aren't familiar with these groups, they're called the Theonomist, the Christian Reconstructionist. And what they say is that not only is the Ten Commandments binding upon us, but those civil commands given to Israel are also binding upon all nations of all times. And if the nation wants to be blessed by God, it must adopt the civil commands given into the Scriptures. Okay? Now, there are other covenantalists who are a little farther this direction on this continuum, who say, no. The civil commands were given to Israel as a nation, And they ended with the ending of God's covenantal relationship with that nation at 70 AD. So that both the ceremonial commands as well as the civil commands are done away with, but the moral commands, namely all 10 of the commandments on the Decalogue, are given to us for our responsibility and for our keeping. Now, I've got a problem with this view in either of those two areas. First of all, while those three divisions, civil, ceremonial, and moral, are nice, neat ways for us to look at the Torah, there is no scriptural evidence and no historical evidence anywhere that the first century Jews saw the Torah in those three compartments. None. A Jew saw the Torah as all moral. If you said to him, well, you know, the sacrifices are done away with because those were ceremonial commands, those aren't moral commands, he would look at you and he'd say, what are you talking about? Yahweh gave us those commands. We must keep Yom Kippur. That is morally binding on our consciences. He wouldn't have said, well, yeah, I didn't thought about that. That's part of the ceremonial parts of the Torah. He wouldn't have seen it in that way. The Torah was a unity. For the Jew, all commands were morally binding, not just the Ten Commandments. Furthermore, all of Moses, according to the New Testament, has in some sense become obsolete. All of Moses. Not the parts which we obviously see as obsolete. Listen to what Paul would say in 2 Corinthians 3:7. Just listen to this. But if the ministry of death, written and engraved on stones, was glorious and was passing away. Now, what was it that was passing away? The ministry of death, written and engraved on what? Stones. What was it that was written on stones? The Decalogue. The Ten Commandments. Not the sacrificial system. Not the civil system. But the Decalogue. Listen to what Colossians 2:14 says. Having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us, which is contrary to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. He's talking about the requirements, the moral requirements, the ethical requirements. He has taken it out of the way. I could just quote massive amounts of verses to this point. So I think to assume that Moses is binding unless we have new covenant grounds for repealing the legislation is faulty. I think you assume Moses is not binding unless you have new covenant grounds to think otherwise. Now, I'm not just splitting hairs here. I'm giving a theological hermeneutic which I think is much more biblical. You assume that Moses is not binding unless you have new covenant declarations which say that a part of that Mosaic code is in fact binding because it reflects the eternal moral law of God. Listen to what Galatians 3:23 through 25 says. The New Testament, by the way, consistently speaks of the law of Moses in the past tense. It consistently does. But before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for the faith which would afterward be revealed. Therefore, the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. Listen to Hebrews 8:13. But now he has obtained a more excellent ministry, inasmuch as he is also a mediator of a better covenant, which was established on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no place sought for a second. In that he says, a new covenant, he has made the first obsolete. Now what did we already see in Exodus 34 is that old covenant. It is the tablets of stone. Obsolete. Now what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. Furthermore, when Paul argues for Christian liberty, he argues for the assumption that the Mosaic Code is not binding on the Christian. In fact, it is weaker brothers who try to enforce the Torah on the consciences of men, not the stronger ones. If your conscience condemns you for things because Moses said it, you're not a stronger brother. You're a weaker brother, according to the New Testament. Now let me wrap all of this up with three points. It is very important to distinguish between the eternal law of God, written on the consciences of all men, and the temporal law of Moses. While God's law was foundational to Moses' law, the two are not identical. The law was given to Moses on Mount Sinai as a specifically fashioned extrapolation of the eternal law of God, designed for the redemptive purpose of condemning us and leading us to Christ. Once Christ comes and inaugurates the new covenant, the old covenant is seen in the New Testament as passing away, vanishing, obsolete, and no longer binding upon the consciences of Christians. Secondly, just because the Christian is not under Moses does not mean that he is not under law. Christ and his apostles reiterate the eternal law of God, like 9 out of the 10 commandments, as binding upon us. In most instances, those commands are even more intense, but wonderfully, and this is where the new covenant is so much more glorious than the old, even though those commands are much more intense and much more exacting, we don't find them burdensome. Isn't that amazing? We delight to do the law of God. You know why? Because God says, in that day I will make a new covenant with my people which will not be like that old covenant, and I will write my law in their hearts. I will give to them my spirit, and they will do all that is commanded within it. So even though the new covenant commands are much more exacting on us than the law of Moses ever was on Israel, they're not burdensome to us like the Torah was to Israel. Because we have a principle of righteousness within the Holy Spirit who is recreating us into the image of God so that the law of Christ becomes the delight of our soul. Thirdly, most importantly, and if you leave here today not remembering anything that I said, please remember this. The law of God in any form is insufficient to justify you. You are sinners, and you cannot possibly meet its prescriptions. We need a lawkeeper, and we need him desperately. And he came, and we find him in the person and work of Jesus Christ, who stands above and beyond Moses because he has kept everything that Moses ever prescribed, and now has intensified Moses and has abrogated part of Moses and has told us what it is that we have as his commands, because he is our perfect law keeper. And you need his righteousness. You need his perfections. And you receive them by faith. By faith you come to him and you say, I have nothing to offer to God. I cannot possibly ever hope to obey God's law. It's just too high. It's just too holy. I need a lawkeeper. And his perfections are given to you so that you stand in the sight of God, perfectly righteous, declared just before him, because you have believed in his only begotten Son. Have you? The table that we are about to enjoy is a table which Jesus says represents the blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission of their sins. It is in the sacrifice that these elements portray visibly to us that we are reminded that our sin barred us from access with God. We could never approach him as sinners. The handwriting of the ordinances was against us. We were without hope in this world. If it were not for the blood of the shed blood of Jesus Christ to wash away our sins in His perfect law keeping, His righteousness to be given to us positively, we could never, ever hope to be in the presence of God for all eternity. So this table reflects and represents the most beautiful gift of God to us. It reflects the gift of His Son, Jesus Christ. It is for everyone who, in unfeigned contrition and faith, says, "His sacrifice was for me. I know it was. I know that He has washed away my sins. I know that His righteousness is mine." This table is for you. It's for you to come and to participate in, and to eat and to drink as a wonderful gift of God in visible form of His love and His grace to us. So come to the table. Don't delay. I also...